Welcome to Let Thurka Play, the podcast that explores the music industry and stories of Black musicians in the Northwest. I'm your host, Miles Green. And for this episode, I talked to jazz vocalist Jacqueline Taper. Let's start the show.
So today is April 19th, 3:45 about, approximately. Sitting here with Jacqueline Taper. Do you want to go by Jacqueline or Jackie?
Jacqueline.
Okay, just want to make sure. Okay.
Thank you. Yeah.
So today with me, I have Jacqueline Taper. Do you want to say hi? Hi, Jacqueline.
Hello, everybody.
Yeah, so I guess to start off the episode, how long have you been in the region?
So I am actually a native. Uh-huh. I was born in Seattle at Doctor's Hospital that does not exist, and I grew up in Bellevue.
Bellevue,
Washington.
Talking about that, what brought you to the main Seattle area?
So my father, believe it or not, was in World War II. Mm-hmm. And he was in the Navy and was in Bremerton. And that's where a few of my siblings, I'm one of five, were born. And they liked it here, and he didn't want to move back to Los Angeles. And so then they lived in Seattle with his mother-in-law, my grandmother, Dorothy Pounds, who was a civil rights activist in Seattle. And they actually owned a daishiki shop that was on 26th and Jackson for years called New Breed. And then, you know, as historically African-Americans, sometimes banking and family doesn't always work out well. So then that went away. And then my grandmother had a column in the Journal American, which existed in Bellevue, and it was about race relations. And so then they moved to Bellevue and thought they were keeping their Black children safe. Mm-hmm. In the suburbs in the 70s.
Yeah. Sounds like a really interesting childhood. Do you have any childhood events that you want to share that kind of helped shape who you are today?
So I had an interesting childhood because I had a father who was lifetime military. I had a mom who grew up on the East Coast who was an only child of a very highly educated, fair-skinned woman who passed to graduate from Columbia and NYU.
Amazing. Wow.
And so my mom was a little bit of a rebellion who didn't, you know, go to college and had five kids and wanted to be a homemaker and can and sew. And so then my grandmother had this article and it talked about race relations. And so we lived on the same street as Glendale Country Club that still exists today in Bellevue on Main Street. And my grandmother called them and acted like a white woman, and then she called as a Jewish woman, and then she called as herself. And, of course, she got denied by all of them, and then we had death threats. And then we had letters from the Klan, and for about 30 to 40 days, I couldn't play in the front yard.
Wow.
And so I kind of had an interesting childhood because I had a lot going on, and I was still trying to be a Black kid in a very suburban area and trying to find my identity. And then at 14, I became Pentecostal. Now, well, I grew up in a very spiritual family that was like Science of Mind. We meditated. And I think I just wanted a Blacker experience. I don't know. I was searching for something. And so about 3 years, I like wore long skirts, went to church three times a week, you know, the entire thing, which taught me how to call and respond, sing, better tempo, how to navigate in a Black community better because I was living in the suburbs. And then I went to a Black college. I went to Southern University and then got my real experience on I'm from Seattle and I don't know nothing about how to navigate at all. So
yeah. What was that experience moving from a majority white population in Seattle and then all of a sudden going to a historically Black college?
I had no idea what I was doing. I was like a lost kid. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know about like ironing my clothes. I didn't know like the slang. I didn't know how to do my hair. I was just like cut off shorts, a t-shirt with holes in it, and you know, talking smack to the guys like I was one of the boys, drinking beer, not drinking booze. You know, I was like lost. I mean, I loved it, but I hated it because I didn't have anybody just like to grab me being like, get your stuff together. So I kind of was a lost soul, but I learned a lot while I did it, but I made a lot of mistakes while I was there.
Sounds almost like you're a West Coast tomboy who maybe was a bit ahead of their time, almost.
I don't know if I was ahead of my time, but I wouldn't call myself a feminist, but I just didn't want to do what everybody wanted me to do very early on. And then my first semester at Southern, my dad passed away. And there's something about a daughter when they lose their father that there's something about this accountability that you no longer have. So needless to say, I really like kicked it at school. I still got decent grades, but I definitely like kind of let my hair down probably further than I needed to. In that I had to start working, and I was still going to school, and then I met my first husband.
Your first one? Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then comparing Seattle from when you were growing up to now, how's it different?
So I was gone for like 15 years. So when I was here, it was not a lot of traffic, not a lot of people of color. Downtown closed at 5 o'clock or 7 o'clock. People didn't come to have concerts here. Like, you'd have to beg the Commodores. You'd have to beg people to come. Like, I saw Two Live Crew at the Paramount. I mean, if you can imagine. And, you know, and the police came and shut it down. So at that time, you couldn't even play rap music in the club because they thought it would start a riot. And then by the time I came back here, there was, you know, coffee stands on every corner. There was all these beautiful African people came, and all these people with Latinos, and all these people from all the world. And I was like, where am I? Which was great. I love that there's so many people. But then I found out about the microaggression. Mm-hmm. That was a whole, like, you know, down south is, oh, bless your heart, you're going to wear that dress. And people would be like, oh, how do you afford those shoes on your salary? You know, so I didn't know what microaggression is. I still don't like it, even though I'm a Seattleite. So that's where it's different, and I feel like the Seattle Freeze is, like, super serious. Like, it's no joke.
Can you explain the Seattle Freeze for people who don't know what it is?
So if you've been here for longer than a week, you've experienced and you just didn't know what it was. People from Seattle are nice enough to an extent at a surface level. They're not probably going to stop and help you. This is the thing. Empathy and sympathy. There's two different things. You have empathy is like, I'm going to get down in the hole with you if it's dark, make sure, like, give you a light.
Right.
Sympathy
right.
is like, oh, it's too bad you're down there in the dark.
Oh, my God.
If I had a flashlight, I'd give it to you, but I don't. So I'm going to go ahead and just hold on to this flashlight because it's kind of getting dark here, but it's not as dark as it is down there. So there's, like, this real difference. And because I live down south, I didn't know what it was, and I feel like it's a new thing. Or maybe it's always been here, and I just was oblivious of it. So that's one thing I don't like. I love that there are people from out of town coming into Seattle, and I feel like they are dismantling that, I don't know if it's like an aristocracy of, I don't know, the Seattle Freeze, but I feel like they're starting to break it down.
They're changing the old ways of
it. Thank goodness. I'm so grateful for it because it's just, it wears me out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I kind of want to go a little bit more into your childhood events. So can you kind of pick just a couple that really shaped who you are today?
I got a lot. I think I went as one of those things that I had it. So in this is, I mean, I'm 49, just in case everybody wants to know how old I am. In the 80s, we still listened to Huckleberry Finn, the album. So if you can imagine, there's maybe one or two black kids in the class and there's like 40 white kids. So in Huckleberry Finn on the album, you know, it's, they drop the N-bomb 30, 40 times. If you can imagine being that black kid, listen to that on a record, it just, like, breaks you. So I said to the teacher, I was like, is there anything else I can do as a black kid to not have to hear this? And she was like, yes, there is. You can read Alice Walker. And so I read the book, did this great report.
Which Alice Walker book did you read?
I'm not going to remember. Too old.
Is it the Color Purple?
No, it wasn't Color Purple. It was something else, and I can't remember. It might have even been Alice Walker. I think it was. No, Why the Caged Bird Sing. Who wrote that?
Was it by Maya Maya? By Maya Angelou?
Was it Maya Angelou? Oh, Lord. Sorry, Maya. My bad.
So anyway, you're reading this book by Maya Angelou.
But, you know, Why the Caged Bird Sings. I do this report, and the teacher, like, at that time I was really rebellious because, like, we had to do a senior report about what you love, and I decided to do my black love. You know, I wore a T-shirt every day that said, I love being black. And all the white kids were mad, and they were like, why are you, you know, what if I wear a shirt, you know, about being white? And I was like, you should. Don't you love yourself? I was super militant. I don't know where that came from my senior year, but I just became that kid. And I think it was because I knew I was going to a black college, and I don't know. I was just in my thing. So anyway, so here I am. I do the book report. What happened was is the superintendent of the Bellevue School District found out about this report I did, found out about, I think because my grandmother was who she was, and I believe there was an article that had gone on about me having to listen to this, and they never went back. They never played the album ever again in the Bellevue School District. Wow. And so that kind of was like, you can make a change. And I, you know, it made me, that really kind of changed who I was. Like, I was okay with myself. And maybe that's why I went to Southern, was like wearing my cutoff and my tie-dye shirt. And like, this is who I am. I've been like that for a while.
Want to take a chance, really.
Yeah, and I just was over it. I really just, honestly, I just didn't want to hear the N-word 30 times in front of some white kids. Like, mm-hmm. It was uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And in the way that album rolls, it's so negative.
How so?
It's just, it feels like if you're a person of color, like you go back in time and you can hear it. It some way jars the, like, your genetics, your soul, that it's so hurtful. It really, really is hurtful. And the more it's said, the worse it's like, oh, damn.
Yeah. And then I guess now we cut to how the music scene changes. How has the music scene changed from your time as a musician, from when you first started to now?
I mean, again, people come to town. We have less venues to perform at, so it's competitive, and networking is excruciatingly important. Your social media profile is very important. Your platform is important. But it's also showing up at other people's gigs, where I don't think that really mattered a couple years ago. There was more jam sessions where people got together and could see each other and physically network, whereas the city is so big, there's no parking. There's no place to play music like we used to. But in that, I think we've all kind of, like, gotten along a little bit better because we know there's only so much pie we all can eat. Mm-hmm. But there is a lot of money here. And I do a lot of corporate events. Somebody's always getting married in Seattle or having a divorce party or having an anniversary party, some kind of party. And people are paying for live music. And there's really no choice. You know, it's either because there's not as many places to go to. So, yeah, it's just changed. And I think it just keeps on changing. I think we also have to be creative as musicians on, like, how we approach, like, go to an art gallery and be like, don't you want music? I mean, we have to be business people more so than creative, which is probably the most difficult part about it, the scene now.
Yeah. Taking a step back from that, what was your first exposure to jazz? And, like, who got you into jazz singing first?
So my high school director, he's still alive, Mr. Jack Hom from Semiamish High School, gave me a tape of Nancy Wilson. And it was Guess Who I Saw Today. And I was like, yeah, she sounds great, blah, blah, blah. And but she was telling this story. And at the end, she, like, oh, my God, what? She saw her man. And I was like, I want to do this. And, you know, Nancy Wilson was so slick and so beautiful. And she wore pants, which is like, oh, I can't believe. Because, you know, singers weren't wearing pants. And nobody understands, like, no female singers were wearing pants. It was a big deal. And she sat out there with her pantsuit and was beautiful, and she was brown skin, and she didn't have long hair running down her back. So for me, she was the one that got me into it. Mr. Hom did too, and he just kind of, like, stirred me along. He also was my choir director. He was the choir director for my sisters, who also went to the same high school. So he was definitely a mentor and, like, almost a family member too.
Has anyone tried to
persuaded you from not getting to jazz and singing?
That would be my ex-husband. Okay. That's why he's my ex. So I lived down south, and we had our own business, and there would always be the radio on, and I would sing, and people would be like, girl, you can sing, you should sing. And he'd be like, no, she can't sing, she doesn't have no time. And we would go to church. We went to First AME in Baton Rouge, which is one of the oldest AME churches in the country. And they would hear me sing, and the choir director would be like, please let her sing. And it was a really good choir, too, and I always kind of been mad about that because it would have been such a good experience. And he just didn't want me to sing. And, you know, he really, like, is always, every once in a while, I'm just like, thank God he didn't want me to for so long, because it would have been wasted with him, because he was a very destructive human being. So by the time I came up here, I was singing in the shower. My sister came in. She was like, I thought you had the radio on. It was you. So, you know, when it was like this dirty little secret I had, and I had been, you know, I always fantasized it the whole time. But by the time I moved back to Seattle, I just started sitting in and got lessons. And, you know, my smoky club, jazz club thing turned into, you know, what I'm doing now, which is, I mean, honestly, it's still crazy. I still can't believe I'm doing it. Mm-hmm.
Those jam sessions, were those during the day or on after hour time?
So
after hour spots.
So let me start off with this. The first band I was with was Black Lab Trio, and my band leader strongly discouraged me from ever going to a jam session. So I didn't really know what a jam session was until I started my own band in 2012. Yes, it's 2019, 2012. Those jam sessions are always at night. Sometimes there's some late night stuff that happens afterwards, which is really where, you know, the magic happens, where, like, there's only like 8 or 9 people in there, and you just, like, take your shoes off and have too much to drink and, like, let it rip. But, you know, sometimes they're competitive. Sometimes you can learn stuff. Sometimes people ask you, like, 1,000 questions, like, where are you playing, blah, blah, blah. But the jam sessions are also where you can see what other people are doing, and they can see what you're doing. And sometimes that's a blessing, like, you know, especially like somebody, like, I was new on the scene, and somebody was like, hey, that girl can sing, and I was getting phone calls and Facebook friends overnight. So that's the jam session.
And then, since you're a woman, were there any certain expectations or unspoken rules that you had to follow once you got these calls for gigs?
Yeah, the woman thing was a trip. So I've been black, I've been a woman, but I had never been just marginalized just as a woman ever until I did my first album, where I was trying to get somebody to engineer my album. And when you first do your album, you have no idea what you're doing. You're just like post-its all over the place and addresses and emails because you've never done it before. There's a lot of moving parts. So I'm trying to get somebody to engineer, and they're just telling me these crazy prices. And so I'm telling all the guys, I'm like, yeah, this guy wants to charge me like $3,000. And he's like, that's BS.
$3,000?
$3,000. This is a while ago. And so all of a sudden, Hans Bremer, who was my piano player at the time, and he sent an email. And all of a sudden, somebody called me back, and they were like, okay, is $600 okay? And I'm like, oh, okay. So because I'm the chick, y'all can't hear me. You know, and it was like the first time I was like, oh, okay, I'm the chick. And, yeah, it's tough being a woman in this industry. I feel like the music industry pits female vocalists against each other. I feel like they're always comparing us to each other. You know, looking good, aging, and, you know, for I'll be honest, my privilege is being a sister in jazz in Seattle. Like, thank God. It definitely opens doors for me and allows me to navigate a little bit easier. I'm not going to lie to you. I do know that a lot of people just call me because they see my picture and they're like, they see jazz. Mm-hmm. I do know that. But they're always impressed once I open my mouth, so that's fine.
Have the rules changed at all since your time as a jazz singer since 2012, or has it gotten easier with building credibility?
I am right now in a spot where everything's sweet right now, so I don't know if I'm objective enough. I have friends who really struggle to get in and do what they want, but I worked very hard over the last couple of years to really like get myself in a situation where I can navigate easily. Ask me that question again.
Or have the rules changed since you first got into singing jazz in Seattle?
Yeah. I would say that there's so many female singers, so many more than there was before, that you gotta always bring your game. There ain't no having no bad night. People are gonna remember you had a bad night. And they're gonna remember the bad night before the great night. So yeah, definitely. There's no half-stepping when you have just even a local gig.
And then have you ever had a situation where you were offered a gig, but then it's just time conflict, and then you just like pass it on to someone who you knew who would probably do a great job?
Absolutely. I have two or three go-tos. They know who they are, Kate Voss, Stephanie Porter. Those are my go-to girls because they pass theirs to me. You don't pass them to everybody because if they don't pass one back, then, you know, that's not equitable.
That's kind of like a rule, like you watch out for each other.
You know, you do. We do, and then there's some lines that sometimes people cross. Sometimes people just get so caught up in what they think they want that's yours that they will step on you to get it. Mm-hmm. I just had an instance about a year and a half ago where a very good friend of mine, a confidant, a fellow singer, decided to take the same project that I was doing, use the same musicians, and produce it before me.
So it was just like cutting you, pretty much.
Absolutely.
Cutting ground in front of you.
Absolutely. But I proceeded with my project. I proceeded to do what I had already planned since I had already documented it, use the same players, and, you know, it was also nominated for an award. So, you know, there you go.
Talent shows, pretty much.
You know, and sometimes you just get MAD and you're going to get even. And, you know, I was a good friend. So I have learned to really keep my allies to myself. I keep my ideas to myself. And it's been hard because I'm a grown woman and it's hard to have betrayal at this age. But yeah. But it happens all the time.
And then when that happens, who do you go to for support or mentorship?
So I have Kate Voss and Stephanie Porter, my really good friends, outstanding vocalists and outstanding human beings. They're really, really nice people. I also work with five other women. I'm fortunate that where I work, they are also my best friends, and they all have significant different personalities and give me this objective thing, and also my husband. My husband's been in this the whole time. And sometimes I'll bounce an idea off, like, what do you think of this? And then he's a poker player and also a fisherman. So he comes with a very different perspective. And so that's how I bounce. And every once in a while, there's other people I'll just bounce ideas off. But I definitely, it's not too many musicians. Not anymore.
Why not?
Because I don't want anybody to steal my idea again.
You ever talk to your old band choir director?
Mr. Holm is still, he actually Facebooks in his 80s, which is very cool. He's still gigging, and when I can catch up with him, I do. And it's just nice to get a like or a love and for him to give me a blessing because, you know, he's known me singing longer than anybody else. Yeah.
When you're making songs and you want it to differ from other ones, that people have done time and time and over again, how do you distinguish yourself when you make the song?
So for the one song I've written, I went to the blues because the blues for me is my comfort zone. I can pretty much put lyrics over any blues song. And I decided to just tell my story, which is, it's the song called Lady in the Gown, and it's about me getting up early in the morning, getting on the bus, working, writing a song list, getting on the bus, and going to a jazz club. That's a real story. Nobody's really written a story about that. And it's easy to sing because it's true. And as far as, like, compositions, I think I also work on arrangements, and I arrange jazz standards. I get inspiration from YouTube. Sometimes I'll listen to opera, or Freddie Mercury is one of my go-to people all the time. God rest Freddie. I miss him so much. Beautiful performer, beautiful voice. And sometimes I just hear something I haven't heard before, and I'll just take a little bit of that. Or I listen to, like, Weeks of Eva Cassidy. I always listen to Cecile McLaurin-Savant, who is the best thing ever. She's our next Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald. She comes to town all the time. I go to all her shows. Mm-hmm. I cyberstalk her. I have pictures with her. I love her. Anyway, right now she's like my true inspiration because I've watched her grow as a band leader, from a vocalist to a band leader.
So. Speaking of growing from a vocalist to band leader, what was your mindset when you're first getting your band together and then first performing on a stage?
So I was with the band for 6 years, and I really wasn't running anything, but in actuality, I was running everything. I was working with a control freak. But I learned a lot. I learned, like, how to, you know, pay musicians fairly, how to treat them politely, how to make sure that they know where to be and what time, because the person I originally worked with did not do any of that. But once I was doing it, it was a little bit scary because I didn't have any fellow female band leaders to tell me, like, don't do this, don't say this, don't wear this. And so I was raised by wolves. Like, the wolves of my band were, like, telling me as, in a male perspective. So I'm kind of lucky because as a female, I got kind of told as a male from males how to run a band. And it was scary. And because I had to be the boss and I had to sing too, and then make sure everybody's on time and make sure everybody's paid. And then I realized, oh, this is a business. And, oh, you got to talk to people and you got to be nice and you got to be on. And, you know, I'd be so tired afterwards. But then somebody broke down, like, how to get paid. Then once they were like, you double your fee because you're the administrator. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I pay everybody else. So, you know, then it's like, if you're getting paid, then you're not as tired because you're happy, you know, and no works out, right? Yeah. You know, you're getting your hustle on. So I made a lot of mistakes. Sometimes I would go to gigs and not get paid, but I was like, it's so much fun. I had a fun time. I was like, no, girl, you need to get paid. Uh-huh. So, but it took a while, though. And then I'll be honest, sometimes there's gigs that I'll do and I won't get paid because I don't need to because it was so much fun. Sometimes if I do fundraisers and stuff, I won't take a payment because it's more about raising money for the cause than it is for me to get paid because I believe in that cause. And if I can give back my fee for that, then I will because it didn't cost me anything, you know. So, but I'm at that point where I can do that and I don't feel like I'm cheating myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you're at these venues and fundraisers and gigs, who's in the audience primarily in terms of demographic-wise?
It is mostly Caucasian. Between the ages, only I know this from my Facebook because I look at my demographic. I mean, between the ages of 40 to 70. However, as I was saying, the people are coming from out of town, thank God. Mm-hmm. I am noticing at least a 7% increase of people of color. There's a lot of people who are relocating here who are from New York or Detroit, and they'll see me and they'll be like, oh, okay, sister, I'm coming to see you. And so I feel like that's also helping the people who are Black and from Seattle to also get out of the house and go ahead and see live music. But I do feel like it's changing. But, you know, most of the time I'm in a room full of mostly older white people.
Have you noticed any younger people at your shows at all?
I have, and I'm surprised, and I'm always so happy, and I always make sure to say hello to those young people and thank them for coming because they could have been doing something else. There's a thing that I say is I always thank people for coming to see anything that's live that's not on their tablet or in their hand.
Why do you do that?
I do that because it costs money to come out. You have to pay for parking. You got an Uber. You might have gotten your hair done. You ate some food. You might have had some booze before. You might have some booze afterwards. It's not a cheap night. And, you know, Saturday I was at Tula's. I had a beautiful, beautiful night. It was sold out. It was 97 people. They all stayed. They kept staying. And, you know, they darn near had to kick them out because they were having such a good time. And for me, I want people to forget what's going on for 3 hours outside of that venue. I want them to have a good time. I want them to love each other and laugh or cry or whatever.
Enjoy the moment.
Just enjoy the moment and have a human experience. And so that's kind of been my thing, because I need a human experience. I work and get on the bus and drive in traffic, and heck, I want to have a good time too.
Yeah, even though you're getting paid for it, and it's your job, you still want that human connection, and that fun that comes with it.
There's no reason. Wayne Dyer said there is no reason to achieve abundance and also achieve your passion. Like, there's no reason not to do it all. So I was really proud of myself, because I was just texting Kate Voss, in fact, and I said, she was getting ready for a gig, and I said, don't forget to have a good time. Don't forget to have fun. My husband says that all the time. He's like, if you're not having fun, you need to stop doing it. Mm-hmm. So I'm reminding myself that, but if I'm happy, and I got the microphone, and my band is happy, then the audience is going to be happy. The wait staff's going to be happy, and we're all going to leave happy, and maybe for the next hour after those people leave, the world be happier. So that's my little thing.
So the little thing, okay. And then, how does race play into the role, how does race play a role in the production and consumption of jazz? You mentioned earlier how, because you're Black, people hired you. How do you think race plays a role in jazz and its production and consumption?
I think most Black musicians that are in Seattle are in high demand. Most of the time, I can't. Like Devon Lewis, one of my favorite drummers, I got to get that brother like 8 months in advance. He's also an extraordinarily like awesome drummer, but he's in high demand. I mean, we're visible. Some people, like in Japan, they think that if it's not a Black person performing jazz, they don't think it's authentic. I was shocked when I went over there, and I was like, oh, okay. I was told by one of my mentors, that because I am not an abrasive Black person, that I navigate easily in corporate America. And I was shocked.
Like, what?
I was like, what? And he was like, you don't, you're friendly and kind, and you know how to talk to people, and so they're going to hire you. And it was one of the most honest things I think a white person has ever told me. And I've kind of just held on to that. Like, he was brave enough to say it to me. It also is a double-edged sword. I have submitted to jazz festivals where they have gotten me and other Black female singers mixed up just recently, not too long ago. Sometimes more than one of us sisters who sing jazz can't be in a jazz festival together, because I think, you know, I don't know what they think. There's too many of us. I don't know what that is. But I've been told politely, like, oh, well, we already have so-and-so, so we couldn't have you too.
So almost like we filled our quota, and now we don't really need anyone else, really.
Right. Yeah, and sometimes I've been told that. I was like, you know, you're singing my ancestors' music. FYI, everybody. Mm-hmm. Like, this is ours. We did this. This is American music, but this is our history. Like, this is ours. And so that's bothered me. I think people are, I've brought it up. Not all of us will bring it up, because it's risky to bring it up. You can look like a loud mouth or embrace a Black woman. I'm almost 50, so, you know, it's let the good times roll. Like, I feel like I need to say something about it. And I've seen some sisters really like show people the inequity on how we're treated, and I appreciate that. When I didn't have the guts, there were some other sisters that stepped up. So it's hard. Sometimes it bothers me, and sometimes, but I know it is also my privilege being a Black woman singing jazz in Seattle.
Okay, switch over to the next page for the very last segment.
Okay.
Knowing that you have a certain privilege in being a Black jazz singer, what are the kind of lessons you've learned through your experience of learning the ins and outs of the business, and also just like having stumbles every now and then?
What I've learned is to forgive myself the next day when I have said something inappropriate, done something inappropriate. You know, just and just try to apologize and be a grown-up. It's difficult because, you know, after a gig, it's been a long day, and I've been at work, and I might have one too many cocktails, and I might say stuff, and I don't always use appropriate language when I have a couple martinis. So I, you know, kind of let it go, like, you know, one of the boys, and that's not always appreciated in the female world. And, you know, I don't really care.
They expect you to act ladylike.
Absolutely.
Almost.
I had somebody who will remain nameless, who's very high up the food chain, tell me that I don't act like other female vocalists. And I was like, well, how do they act? And he was like, not like you.
But I'm just acting like me.
And I was like, it's nice to meet you too. You know, it's like, you know, what do you want? I mean, I've always been one of the, obviously, we already started with the child. I've always been one of the boys. You know, it's just, it's, and I don't mean that in a bad way, just, that's who I am. And I feel like sometimes for a couple of years, I really wanted to fit in the mold. I really wanted to be, you know, pretty in pink and do what they want. And then about a year and a half ago, I let my hair go natural. And that's nothing. It's like that today. But that was really difficult. I was shocked. I was shocked how scared I was to wear my hair natural. I was shocked that I was scared to take pictures like that. It was like, so I just kind of like made myself do it for a year.
How did people perceive you from that?
I was, you know how folks always want to touch it. So I had to teach everybody, don't touch. It's not on display. I think that was a good lesson, because many of those people were my very good friends. And so, you know, people are like, why haven't you worn your hair like that? Or such and such. And I'm like, well, you know, because I have my own internal racial oppression. And I thought that, you know, this is what we wanted. I'm currently wearing vintage hair. And I love wearing vintage hair because, A, it's fun. It's super creative.
It looks good.
Thank you.
Looks good. People can't see it right now, but it looks good. It's just so you guys know.
Thank you. And I feel like I'm kind of honoring, like, the history of the music. And I'm on a vintage hairdo Facebook ran by my fan Robin. And I love sharing techniques with other women. And there's a lot of African-American women on that Facebook, and we're from all over the world, and it's a space where if you don't wash your hair every day, it's not a problem. So if there's any sisters out there, you know what I'm talking about. So it's just, that's the other thing. It's just nice to be creative with my hair.
Mm-hmm. Then what's next for your band?
Well, Big Mama, as I refer to myself, is taking a break. I just finished Seattle Jazz Repertory Orchestra thing in February, which was exhausting and great at Benora Hall and everything. And what's coming up next is I'm finally in the Ballard Jazz Festival.
Congratulations.
I know, it's only been 15 years, so I'm glad they finally called us, sisters. So that's June 1st. May 30th, I will be at the Bellevue Jazz Festival with Marina Albera, who is from Barcelona. And she's a very exciting pianist. And then in July, I got so many gigs. In July.
I was going to say, you're busy.
I know. Okay, wait. What we got? Oh, wait. I'm just going to rattle off some dates since you're going to give me a little PR. So the 30th, we're at Bellevue Jazz Festival. The 1st of June is Ballard Jazz Walk. June 8th, we'll be at Hotel Sorrento. July 18th, I'll be at Tula's Jazz Club. I'm really excited about that. And I'll have Michael Brockman playing saxophone, who is the director of SRJO. Then I'll be at the Ellensburg Jazz Festival. Yes, there is a jazz festival in Ellensburg. It's super cool. That's July 26th. And then I'm really excited about the Seattle Art Museum. That's a free concert that's downtown Seattle on the 12th of September, and that will be recorded hopefully by Jim Wilkie. And I mean, I have a whole bunch of other ones, but if you want to check me out, find me on Facebook at taborjazz.com. TaborJazz.com is my website. Tabor Jazz is my Facebook. And I'm at Jacqueline Tabor on Instagram and Tabor Jazz at Twitter. Is that correct? Did I do all that right?
I can fix that at the very end. The Seattle Art Museum, gig looks very interesting. That looks very interesting. Did you see the exhibit for the Kenda Wiley and the Forgotten History exhibits? No?
I didn't see that.
Okay. There are exhibits about Black history, about Black artists, and so that may...
No, but okay. I need to see who's going to be there in September, because I think that Thursday is, those Thursdays are free.
Yes, for the first Thursday.
Yep.
And then, I guess kind of getting back on track, what do you bring to a performance that no other band does at all?
A genuine human being. I am, I will cry, I will tell bad jokes, I will change lyrics to songs, I will laugh at myself, and I will make you forget that the world is crazy outside of the venue. And I hope that when people, I think what I bring is when you come, and you might be a stranger, but we will definitely leave as friends.
Any remaining thoughts before you sing us a little jingle?
Oh my God, sing a jingle. Jazz is cool. We need y'all to come out and see us. We miss you. It won't kill you to come to a gig. Anybody, no matter what genre it is, no musician can survive without an audience. So we need you. What do you want to hear, baby?
Anything.
Something sad, happy, what you want?
Let's go happy.
Okay. Happy. I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast. I fall in love so terribly hard with a love that may never last. My heart's been fooled. I've been schooled in the past. I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast.
Whew. Whew. Spicy.
Oh, man. When's your first show? When's your first show? The Bellevue Jazz Festival?
Yeah.
Ooh, I'm gonna try.
You need to come on out. Yeah, man. Send the beat down. He's so crazy.
Thank you so much for coming on to the episodes. Thank you. I love this.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
Okay. And that wraps up the episode. Special thanks to my editor, Christine McMangle, and Jacqueline for coming on to the podcast. Check out Jacqueline's website, taborjazz.com. All of our social media info is in the episode's description, along with upcoming gig dates. I'm your host, Niles Green. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.